We think the opportunities could be very real, and we think customers would appreciate it.
Congress considers a new use for Alaska's gas as fuel for cars. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a call for clemency for protest fishermen on the Kuskokwim River.
This is the first time in the history of the state of Alaska where people who are subsistence fishing have become criminals.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
Lawmakers in Washington are considering what it would take to use natural gas in more cars. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, there's some potential for using Alaska's gas, though there are huge barriers.
In parts of the state, natural gas is looking as appealing as ever, with gasoline prices soaring up to the $10 range and an abundance of the cleaner burning gas. But appealing does not automatically make something practical.
It's generally a neighborhood of about $5,000 to put a unit in your home.
That's Chrysler's Reg Modlin, testifying before the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. He's talking about the initial cost of installing a natural gas refueling unit in someone's garage. Just like electric vehicles that plug in and the owner pays through the monthly utility bill, an ideal setup for natural gas would be diverting power from your house into your car. Modlin says industry is looking to lower the price by about a third, and home refueling is not some pie-in-the-sky idea.
We think the opportunities could be very real, and we think customers would appreciate it.
Of course, there's another option. Filling stations can install pumps for natural gas. There's already one in Anchorage. Larry Persily is the federal coordinator for the Alaska Gas Pipeline and says there are more natural gas fueling stations coming down the line.
The problem is cost $500,000 to put in a natural gas fueling station. I'm not going to do that unless I know I've got enough customers who are going to fill up so I can cover my costs.
Cities have been able to invest that money for long-term savings. Here in Washington, D.C., buses are now powered by natural gas. Persily says individuals will not start buying natural gas vehicles, which are more expensive than gasoline-powered ones, until there are enough stations equipped with natural gas pumps. There are only about 1,000 natural gas-ready stations in the country, with more than 100 in California alone. So it comes down to economic basics, supply and demand.
There's a lot of gas on our slope. The problem is getting it anywhere. And you would never be able to afford a pipeline off the North Slope just to refuel trucks and cars in Fairbanks.
Oil companies, Persily says, would only be willing to make a $40 to $50 billion investment in a pipeline from the North Slope if they're able to export liquefied natural gas. For her part, Senator Lisa Murkowski has met with East Asian diplomats to make the pitch for Alaskan LNG. Some Democrats, though, are saying we need to slow down. Representative Ed Markey, a Massachusetts Democrat and a leader on energy issues in the House, trying to move an amendment that would have stopped the U.S. from exporting its natural gas. And in the Senate, Ron Wyden says that though consumers have enjoyed low natural gas prices for years, volatility remains high. And Wyden says entering the international marketplace would not reduce that volatility.
This, of course, would happen if you had these LNG export terminals constructed, certainly has the potential to worsen the problem. Because if you think guessing on the future of natural gas prices was a challenge before, add the international competition from companies that are already paying four or five times as much.
Persily dismisses this as political grandstanding. And though that may be the case, it may not stop with the election. Wyden is slated to become the top Democrat on the Natural Resources Committee in January. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The Federal Office of Surface Mining has questioned the validity of the Yucabeli coal mining permits for the Wishbone Hill prospect near Palmer. In a letter to the State Department of Natural Resources, Division of Mining, Land and Water, OSM's Kenneth Walker states that the federal agency finds gaps in permitting information furnished to OSM by the state. OSM has requested that the Division of Mining, Land and Water conduct a file review on the Wishbone Hill mining permits and to provide OSM with further information. This latest development in a lengthy and contentious debate over the Wishbone Hill coal development drew cheers from environmental groups opposed to coal mining. Kirby Spangler is with the Castle Mountain Coalition.
They have no mining permit right now. The letter that OSM sent to the state does give the state 10 days to justify the Wishbone Hill mining permit.
Yucabeli has conducted mining exploration activities at Wishbone Hill since 2010. Yucabeli spokeswoman Lorelei Simon says OSM's intervention at this time is an example of federal overreach.
It seems to me that no matter what evidence the state provides to the federal government over its own coal program, the federal government, led by the Obama administration, is going to always have a problem with it.
Simon contends Yucabeli's mining permits are still valid. She says the state has provided statements of the validity of the Yucabeli permits to the federal agency in the past. The state has 10 days to respond to OSM's letter. The Association of Village Council Presidents is officially asking for clemency for Kuskokwim River subsistence fishermen sighted during closures. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning-Barnes reports.
Although big-name attorneys have stepped forward to represent the fishermen in court, AVCP President Myron Nanning believes it doesn't need to go that far.
This is the first time in the history of the state of Alaska where people who are subsistence fishing have become criminals because they're being charged for misdemeanors and fined, while the Bering Sea trawl fleet throws salmon overboard with no penalties at all.
About 41 fishermen were sighted, most of them in June, during a 12-day salmon fishing closure put in place by state and federal managers to help protect the Poor King Salmon Run. Over 30 fishermen were sighted June 20th, when, at the direction of their elders, went out to fish for their families. AVCP denies that it was a fishing protest, saying the fishermen fished out of fear and desperation for getting enough food for the winter in a time of high gas and heating fuel prices. In Bethel, gas and heating fuel is close to $7 a gallon, and in some villages, it's close to $10. In a press conference Friday, Governor Sean Parnell alluded that it was too early for clemency.
As far as I know, nobody's been convicted, which is when clemency comes in. But at this point, it's prosecutorial discretion in terms of what happens with those charges.
Parnell said he hasn't gotten involved in such procedures in the past.
I never, that I can remember, have been engaged in manipulating or controlling prosecutorial discretion. I wouldn't do that. So that is left up to the Department of Law, and that'll continue to be their purview.
Nanning says it is unfair that subsistence fishermen are paying the highest price while others who are fishing for money get to waste fish. He says the region's tribes share the same concern.
Well, the village concerns that I've heard is that why is the state of Alaska taking such a heavy hand in criminalizing people that are fishing for food when they're not doing anything about those people that catch, as a bycatch, Chinook salmon out in the Bering Sea and just throw it overboard. You know, there's no justice in that.
State prosecutors offered fishermen a plea deal during their arraignment, which included cutting the fine in half and giving back their seized nets. Some fishermen took it, but about a few dozen others pled not guilty and will face trial starting in August. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, is Congressman Don Young turning over a new leaf?
Aloha, I'm Maisie Hirono, and I'm a Democrat.
I'm Don Young of Alaska, and I'm a Republican.
Yes, you certainly are, Don.
Well,
that's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
When Shell secured a court order to keep Greenpeace from protesting near its Arctic drilling expedition, the environmental group decided to strike back by pretending to be Shell. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more.
At a glance, a new billboard near Shell Oil's corporate headquarters in Houston looks like any Shell ad. It features Shell's name and logo and their ad slogan, "Let's Go." It also shows two polar bears lazing on an iceberg. Superimposed on the bears is a new Shell slogan, "You can't run your SUV on cute." Those words are definitely not Shell's, and neither is the billboard. They both belong to Greenpeace. In the last 6 weeks alone, Greenpeace has hosted a fake Shell press conference, created a fake Shell website, and even circulated a fake press release from Shell's lawyers threatening to sue Greenpeace for their internet masquerade. Greenpeace spokesman James Turner says Shell forced the environmentalists' hand.
Let's be clear about the origins of this. Shell took out an injunction against Greenpeace, which prevents any of our peaceful protests from happening within 1 kilometer of any of their vessels. Which is why we came up with this campaign.
Turner says the new approach honors that injunction, and it's far more effective than any petition or email campaign.
You know, it's not something we do lightly. We're not doing it for fun. We're doing it because there is a very, very serious issue at stake.
But Greenpeace's fake Shell website, ArcticReady.com, is far from serious. Visitors can blast through Arctic sea ice in the game Angry Birds. The Let's Go social ad creator is the centerpiece of the site. Greenpeace provides a template and photos of oil derricks, icebergs, seabirds, fish. You can fill in the blanks, creating your own catchy slogans to match the photos and vote on the ads you like best. The ad generator is the source of the new billboard in Houston, and it's the reason why the site's gone viral. Turner says ArcticReady.com pulled in 2 million page views in a single week. Turner says he thinks the ad generator is raising awareness about the caveats of Arctic drilling. People are engaging with the subject matter, he says, and that could eventually translate to a bigger political campaign against drilling. Shell strongly disagrees.
There's a credible conversation, and they're not part of it. It undermines their own credibility for the long term.
That's Curtis Smith, Shell's spokesman in Alaska. He says he's not amused with Greenpeace's tactics. It's not clear if Greenpeace will benefit from this campaign in the long run, or how. They might not know how much support they've garnered until the project enters its final stages, which Turner says will translate increased awareness into, quote, political pressure. As for Shell, Smith says their primary concern right now isn't Greenpeace. Shell doesn't plan to sue. Instead, they're trying to clear the final hurdles before their drilling expedition can head to the Arctic this summer. Smith says they're still waiting on Coast Guard certification for the last ship in their fleet. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
In Sitka, declining cruise traffic has city leaders considering the possibility of building a downtown dock. Right now, visitors arriving aboard large vessels are ferried to shore on smaller boats. Those in favor of the dock hope it will bring more money into the community. Those against the dock are concerned it could overwhelm Sitka's downtown. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
A navy blue Holland America ship is anchored in Sitka Sound. Passengers are combing through downtown stores, and on this Thursday afternoon, I'm walking along Sitka's main drag, Lincoln Street. I'm joined by Tanya Ryu. She runs the Sitka Convention and Visitors Bureau. What do you see when you look around?
I see a lot less people for a cruise day than what we used to see downtown. And I see some empty storefronts and a lot of sale signs in the window, like discount sale signs, liquidating. And some shops are actually, they have goods in them, but they're closed right now, even though it's still early afternoon.
This scene was a little different 4 years ago, when nearly 290,000 passengers came to Sitka on cruise ships. This year, 106,000 people are expected to arrive that way. It's a little more than a third as many people, and it is the lowest number in at least 15 years.
By nature, I'm always very optimistic. but the reality of things right now is that people are very worried, and I feel like there's cause for that. There's valid cause for concern.
We stop for a minute in front of an empty store at the corner of Lincoln and American Streets. A sign behind the building reads, "Parking for Colin only." That is Colin Herforth, but he's not parking there anymore. He and his wife, Christy Jones, ran the Fairweather Gallery and Gifts from this location for 17 years. But this year, they moved the business to Juneau.
When we got the cruise ship calendar last fall for this coming season, and we saw that it was down again further, somewhere we were around 100,000 tourists, visitors for cruise ships, versus a million in Juneau, it seemed like, well, how can we not do this?
An Irish dancer is performing underneath the O'Connell Bridge, where a long line of cruise passengers has formed. They're waiting for boats that will take them back to their ship. So we walked around and asked them, would they spend more time and more money in Sitka if there was a dock?
No, because it seems to be the way they schedule the trips. Like, I was here several years ago, and it seems like we spent a whole day here before.
Mary Fickerson is from Santa Paula, California. It is her second time to Sitka. She echoes the concern of some residents who worry that a dock would overwhelm downtown Sitka and change its character. She compared Sitka to Juneau, where the ships tie up to shore.
Juneau is much more commercialized. There's, you know, a whole line of ships, big ships, and it's just, this is much prettier.
On the other hand?
I think it would be a fantastic idea.
Why?
Because it's too cold out here, and that takes too long. We want to get in and out.
That's Lori McCutcheon-Sackelson, and she's with her friend Elise Dudek. They're both from Pittsburgh, and they came ashore around 8 a.m. They're holding several bags from Ben Franklin, the New Archangel Trading Company, and more. They say most of their time was spent shopping. Here's Dudek.
I like to spend money, and I would spend more money if I had more time instead of having to take this boat. It was just too much back and forth.
I'm John Binkley, and I serve as the president of the Alaska Cruise Association.
The association lobbies on behalf of the major cruise lines that stop in Alaska ports.
For a community to just build in and assume that they will show up, I think is not wise.
Binkley says it is good that Sitka is having this conversation, and a conversation it is, a robust one too, at least online. Resident Thanny Bean started a Facebook group called Sitka Dock, Should or Should Not. It began on July 10th.
You know, I think I invited about 30 or 40 people.
2 weeks later, the size of the group has more than tripled. As for the title issue, Sitka Dock, Should or Should Not?
It's a pretty even 50-50 split. You know, there's people that are caught in the gray area, too.
Bean is not in the gray area. He thinks a dock would be beneficial. But mostly, he just wants to see the conversation continue. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
This July is on track to be one of the coldest ever in Anchorage. As of today, the average temperature for the month is just 55 degrees, a bit shy of the coldest July on record, which came in at 54.4 degrees in 1920. The normal average is 58 degrees. Dave Snyder is a meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Anchorage. He says the same weather pattern that is heating up the lower 48 is making it colder than normal over south-central Alaska and keeping storms over the area.
The storms have been passing over frequently, but also kind of returning back in the same direction. They keep circulating over and over and over again. And instead of progressing forward down the weather pipeline, because of the big high-pressure system that's been sitting over the lower 48, which has made them very, very hot.
Snyder says it's called a blocking pattern, and it's not that unusual for summer, but it doesn't usually stick around so long. He says it may be happening partly because the northern hemisphere is slowly switching from a La Nina cycle to El Nino. But Snyder says parts of Alaska have escaped the cold weather.
Dead horse yesterday, I believe, at 78 degrees, which is, you know, you might say equally unusual. But northern areas have been pretty mild. Places in, around Fairbanks have seen some fairly warm temperatures. So this might just be more of a south-central, southeast issue, you know, and talk to people farther north and they might say, yeah, it's been a great summer.
Snyder says Anchorage can expect better weather in the coming days, but the cold, wet weather has significantly slowed vegetable growth at Matanuska Valley Farms. Allie Barker runs Chugach Farm in Chickaloon.
It's definitely taken its toll on farming this season. We're seeing our growth is a lot of, say, tomatoes and peppers and squash. We're at least a couple weeks, you know, two, maybe even 3 weeks behind with some things than where we are normally this time of the year.
Barker says vegetables are also smaller this year, but she's not giving up hope the season will end on a high note. She says a beautiful fall could salvage some longer growing crops like carrots.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922, on the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
At midnight last night, Katmai National Park and Preserve switched on newly installed webcams around Brooks Camps, and viewers can now tune in to a live feed of the park's famous grizzlies. KDLG's Dave Benninger reports.
One of the most popular bear viewing spots in the world just became a little more accessible, thanks to the internet. Four spots around the famed Brooks Camp in Katmai National Park and Preserve are now viewable via webcam, streaming 24 hours a day. Roy Wood is the chief of interpretation at the park. He says the cams are set up at some prime vantage points.
When we decided to reinstall the webcams out at Brooks Camp, the real obvious choice was to stick one in at Brooks Falls, which is the iconic location where bears stand at the lip of the waterfall and catch the salmon as they leap the falls. And, you know, in many cases, the bears are able to snag the fish in midair, which is, you know, a spectacular photo opportunity. And now anybody with the internet access can watch that for hours and hours and hours each day.
There were webcams at this site once before, but the costs were too high to maintain at the time. These new cams were made possible through a partnership with Explore.org, which is underwritten by the Annenberg Foundation. It's a partnership Wood says the park is pleased with.
They're a perfect partner for something like this because we pretty much have the same goals of educating the people of the world about Katmai. And, you know, it's a very pure motive to just keep learning about the planet and learning about the animals.
Between the four installed webcams, Wood thinks there will be great bear viewing opportunities, not just all summer long, but into September and October as well, when there's a lot of bear activity, but Brooks Camp is closed. He says the webcams will be operational until the snow covers the solar panels that power them, but of course by then the bears themselves will have headed off to find their winter dens. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
A federal commemoration of homesteading in America recognizes six Alaskans considered the last to participate in the program. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the last woman homesteader and her son gained title to land near Big Delta in 1984.
Bob King is an historian with the Bureau of Land Management, and he says his agency is celebrating the 150th anniversary of the 1862 Homestead Act because that triggered the westward expansion by 1.6 million Americans into what were then remote regions of the United States. And that historic wave of settlers helped promote the mythic notion of rugged individuals carving out a home in the wilderness.
Probably the archetypical idea of homesteading is here's somebody in a covered wagon, they're rolling west and they're claiming land and they're felling trees and so forth.
King has extensively studied the history of homesteading, and he's helping direct the Alaska BLM office's observance of the sesquicentennial. Homesteading didn't begin in Alaska until 1898, and although it didn't play as big a role in the settlement of the last frontier, King says it did provide some 3,500 Alaskans with a chance to gain land before the program ended here in 1986, 10 years after it ended in the lower 48.
In Alaska, we had the very last homesteaders in the United States. We were a young state, And that was one of the reasons why homesteading was allowed for an additional 10 years.
He says that's why when the BLM launched its Homestead Act commemoration, agency officials came to Alaska.
We're fortunate here in Alaska to still have many of our pioneer homesteaders around.
The last six American homesteaders are all Alaskans, and they include two from the interior, Delta Junction residents Betty Smith and her son Bill. Betty Smith says she didn't know anything about the remote land west of the Tanana River that she filed to homestead in 1974. Smith was a widow at the time, working hard to support her five kids, and she says it just seemed like homesteading was a good way to gain title to some land and maybe a chance to get ahead.
It was like an opportunity.
Her son, Bill, was 18 and was also invited to homestead by a group of friends and neighbors who all filed to homestead across the river, all of whom lived in Big Delta, a community about 8 miles north of the town of Delta.
As a group, it worked out because we were all kind of working together on it. And it was kind of rough times for us, so we didn't have a lot of money. So all we could really contribute was labor.
Bill Smith says he didn't know much about construction or farming. The program required both building a dwelling and raising crops in order to prove up and qualify for title to the land. But Smith says he understood enough to know that a homestead was something worth working for.
I think we just did it because it was an opportunity that popped up that nobody knew about.
Both Betty and Bill Smith persevered, and in October 1984, Betty gained title to her homestead, as did Bill soon thereafter. That made Betty the last woman in America to be granted a homestead. The BLM honored her with a trip to the Homestead Memorial in Nebraska, her native state, and by including her in the agency's commemoration during Anchorage's 4th of July celebration. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
One last story tonight. Congressman Don Young is crossing the aisle.
Aloha, I'm Maisie Hirono, and I'm a Democrat.
I'm Don Young of Alaska, and I'm a Republican.
Yes, you certainly are, Don.
And despite that difference in party, Young is endorsing Hirono in her Democratic primary for the United States Senate. Hirono is in her third term in the House. She's a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. So the video released today of her and Young sharing stories of their strong relationship caught many by surprise.
When vital Native Hawaiian and Native Alaskan education programs were at risk in Congress,
Maisie and I got together and put our partisan differences aside and solved this problem for our people at home.
And once Don and I joined together as Republican and Democrat, I had to battle my own party leadership to get our amendment passed.
It's true. I watched Maisie do it. And let me tell you, that Nancy Pelosi is one stubborn...
Don, what have I told you?
I will not say anything else.
Hirono is running against former Representative Ed Case in the primary, and that's as far as Young's support will go. A spokesman from his office says he will not campaign for her in the general election when she has to face a Republican. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska. Ed Ronco in Sitka, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Tim Ellis in Delta. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Rasmussen Foundation Sabbatical Program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth, and organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. Avtech is recruiting rural Alaskans for computer and network training with no cost tuition for qualified applicants. For more about the Village Internet Agent Program, call 1-800-478-5389. This message sponsored by Avtech, Alaska's Institute of Technology.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.